You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How natural is your diet? Do you worry about the long-term effects of consuming genetically modified meat and produce? 60% of Americans surveyed report they have never eaten GM foods. But get this, at least 80% of the corn and 86% of the soybeans grown in this country today are derived from genetically modified seed stock. So why don't we know what we are really putting into our bodies? And why have U.S. consumers not raised nearly the level of protest as their counterparts in Europe? Lisa H. Wiesel is a molecular biologist and professor of biology at Portland State University. She explores these issues in her new book, Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. Lisa, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. Will you give us a good definition of what qualifies as a genetically modified food?
Sure. When we talk about genetically modified foods, we're usually referring to what we call transgenic plants, and that means plants that have a gene from a foreign species, a different species, either another plant, a bacteria, even a human, put into them. So you take the DNA out of a human or a bacteria or another plant, put it into the food plant, and that enables that plant to express this new foreign protein that wouldn't normally be produced by that plant.
So it changes the properties of the plant itself.
It does. It causes the plant to produce a foreign protein that's not usually part of that food.
Are there any requirements at all that these foods be labeled so that in this country, at least, we know what we are eating?
No, in the United States, these foods are not labeled, and several attempts at labeling measures here within the state of Oregon, where I live, in 2002, we had a ballot measure asking whether we should label these foods, and that was not approved. So in the United States, there is no labeling requirement for genetically modified foods.
So how exactly are these new foods created? Can you talk very basically about how these different genetic materials are inserted into what would ordinarily be a corn seed?
Yes, so this is a technology that arose in the 1970s and is very commonplace today. It's very easy to extract DNA from any organism. We do that routinely when we use forensic DNA studies, when DNA is used in the courts, for example. So the technology exists to extract DNA from one organism, a plant or a bacteria, cut it up using enzymes to cut out the gene of interest, and then using other enzymes that act like glues to glue that new gene into the genome, into the DNA of that food plant. So today it's fairly easy in the laboratory to extract DNA, cut out the pieces that you're interested in, and paste them into another species. So that has to be done in the laboratory. Those plants are then grown up in the laboratory and can then be put out into the field to be grown as regular plants and then seeds gathered from those transgenic plants that were made in the laboratory. So this is very different from conventional genetic breeding that has been around for many centuries that we've traditionally relied upon for our crop plants, where you cross-pollinate. You use the plant's own reproductive structure, either in the field or in the laboratory, using pollen. So this circumvents that pollination step and goes directly to the DNA of the plant.
So what do we know about accidental cross-pollination? Once these plants have been out in a farmer's field somewhere, is there a chance that the new genes that have been inserted into them will find their way into other species?
There is, because plants grown out in the field will pollinate naturally using wind, using other pollination vectors, birds, insects. So the real concern is where you have close relatives, so either an organic or a non-genetically modified crop of the same kind. So if you have organic corn grown down the street from a genetically modified corn field, then corn is a very, very good cross-pollinator. It's wind-pollinated, and those corn tassels will blow, and the next generation of corn will contain those genetically modified genes that were put in. Another issue would be a close relative. So here in Oregon, we grow a lot of sugar beet seeds, and some new genetically modified sugar beet crop has recently been planted, and there's some evidence that that's cross-pollinating into close relatives like table beets or Swiss chard. And then finally, there's the issue of cross-pollination into weeds, closely related weed species. Wild mustards, for example, are close relatives of the canola plant, which is a common GM crop. And if those genes get into weeds, then those weeds will then have those properties. And often those are properties that we don't want weeds to have. We want only the crop plants to have.
And aside from this question of labeling or notification to consumers, which we've already talked about, if, for example, these genes got into a species where they weren't meant to be, there's really no way to know that if you bought, say, organic Swiss chard, that it might actually have been contaminated.
That's right. It's only at the genetic level in the laboratory using molecular biology and molecular techniques that you'd be able to detect that, because, of course, there's no overt, there's no label on the crop growing up, and there's no overt property that you would notice that would tell you what is going on inside that plant at the molecular level. So these are changes at the molecular level that are only detectable that way.
Lisa Wiesel is my guest. She's professor of biology at Portland State University. Her new book is called Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. So, Lisa, will you talk about some of the most common reasons for making these modifications? We've heard about disease resistance, but there are a lot of different things that we can do.
Yeah, so there's two primary traits that are used in the genetically modified crops commercially available today. And the primary trait is herbicide resistance. So those plants are engineered to resist the application of herbicides, which are weed killers, things like Roundup. And those plants were made by taking a soil bacteria that was actually found in a waste swamp of Monsanto's, where they were dumping the Roundup at a Roundup production facility. Some bacteria were able to survive in those waste ponds, and they were able to extract the gene that allowed those bacteria to survive and to resist the effects of that weed killer and to stay alive despite all of this chemical application. They took that gene out and they put it into crop plants, so things like corn and soy. And so now those crop plants are resistant to the herbicide, resistant to the weed killer, which under other circumstances, if that gene wasn't there, they would die when the herbicide was applied. And that now allows farmers to fly over their fields and spray Roundup from the air, large amounts of Roundup over the entire field. All the weeds will die and the crop plants will grow up. In the past, before that trait was available, weeding would have to take place either through mechanical tilling and cultivation or through careful applications of the herbicide at a time when the crop plant was not in a sensitive stage. So that's the primary trait that's out there that allows crop plants to resist the effects of weed killers.
How does all this affect the yields of these plants?
Well, yield, of course, is a big controversial issue. And part of the goal of developing genetically modified crops, and just part of it, of course, is yield increase. So there's been a lot of attention to the idea that, well, this must dramatically increase yields. And the yield increase question really depends on the environmental conditions, the climate, what kind of drought effects you're experiencing that year. So it's highly variable. It's very difficult to get to really pinpoint yield. It does appear that some of these GM traits will increase the yield, especially in things like BT cotton, which is an insecticide trait, which I haven't mentioned yet, but putting an insecticide trait into cotton under some conditions will increase yield, but under other conditions, the yield might drop because you're having this monoculture, you're having the effects of this gene. So what they're really looking at is profit increase. And profitability, you know, is the bottom line. Cost input, cost output. And for large-scale industrial agriculture, in many cases, these traits are making profitability sense.
So it makes things cheaper for the producers. Does it make the crops any cheaper for people who are buying them in the supermarket?
No, I think one of the big problems we have with our industrial agricultural system is that profit largely accrues at the top to the companies producing the seeds, the companies that hold the patents on the seeds. And as we see, farmers aren't really making it big and rich in this country. Farmers are still struggling. So I think that, and then as farmers struggle, it's not the consumers that are benefiting from really dramatic savings on food either. So I think what we're seeing is profits accumulating at the very top of the agricultural chain, and these GM traits just adding to that because they are protected by patents, and that brings in a lot of income. But it hasn't really trickled down in the way that we might hope.
So when we hear about 80% of corn grown in this country, 86% of soybeans, it would seem that farmers are wholeheartedly embracing this technology. Is that the case, or do they simply have very little choice in the matter?
Yeah, so that's an important question. I just want to correct you. That's 92% of the soybeans grown last year, 86% of the cotton. But in 2008, 92% of soybeans, 80% of corn grown in this country were genetically modified varieties. And in my research, what I heard from a lot of farmers and a lot of seed suppliers is that farmers aren't necessarily enthusiastically embracing these crops. Some are, yes, but in general, farmers are doing it because the guy down the street is doing it, everyone else is using these traits, and because, as you mentioned, seed dealers aren't offering other varieties. There's a very complicated negotiation that takes place in terms of what variety seed dealers offer, and we're seeing a really decreasing supply and decreasing choice of non-GM varieties. It's primarily just the organic market now. The organic seeds prevent the use of genetic modification. So organic seeds will be non-GM, but most of the rest of the varieties that are offered tend to be genetically modified varieties. So there is very little choice for farmers in that matter.
On the other hand, we have learned in the past couple of years that it's possible that, organic meat products and milk products may actually have used animals that have been exposed to this stuff as feed.
That's right. Most of the genetically modified crops in this country, because they are soy and corn, are going to animal feed, not to human food. Of course, any processed food in the supermarket that contains soy or corn ingredients will be made from genetically modified corn, just because of the cross-pollination and the contamination issues in the food processing. But the large majority of soy and corn grown in this country go to animal feed. So, yes, animals, whether the meat or the milk ultimately get certified as organic, may be fed these genetically modified crops currently.
So what do we know about how all of this acts in the human body and how that differs from a crop that has never been modified?
Well, there hasn't been a huge amount of research, particularly at the human level, because that would require very large epidemiological studies. Since these foods aren't labeled, we don't really know who's eating them, how much of them, and what any kind of subtle health effects might be. Obviously, we haven't had any drop-dead outbreaks where consuming small amounts of genetically modified ingredients are causing dramatic health effects and people are suddenly falling ill. But we do have a lot of chronic health problems in this country, things like asthma, allergies, childhood allergies, even cancer, diabetes. A lot of our health conditions here are chronic and probably multifactorial. So I think that because we don't have a grip on who's been eating these in large amounts and you know, what, it's impossible to do these epidemiological studies. So human, and of course it's not ethical to have human feeding studies where we would feed an experimental food to humans. So there have been animal studies, but I think one of the biggest problems is that the companies do all the safety testing themselves and then present that data to the government. So there's no independent safety testing done or required. So that is a bit of a loophole in terms of looking for unbiased safety testing.
And let's talk about that testing for a minute, because even if an independent lab or a university somewhere wants to get some of this stuff and on its own dime test these materials, often they are not allowed.
That's correct, because these seeds are controlled by the companies. They're intellectual property rights given. So if researchers want to use these seeds, they need to apply to the company, disclose what kind of research they're doing. And it's really at the will of the company whether these seeds are given out for research products. It's a bit ironic since 92% of the soybeans grown in this country are genetically modified varieties, but researchers can't necessarily get their hands on them. Researchers can't go to a farmer and say, hey, you've got genetically modified soybeans. Can you give me some to do research? Because the farmers themselves sign a licensing agreement that says they will not give out those seeds to anyone. They will only use them on their farm. So it's a bit of a blockade here for public research on these crops and these seeds.
And we should also say that some of these seeds are modified so that farmers can't simply take seed from the crops that they grew last year and reuse it next year.
So that's the Terminator technology, which renders the next generation of the plant sterile. And that, of course, companies were interested in pursuing that technology because with the intellectual property rights, if the farmers would save those genetically modified seeds and use them the next year, they wouldn't be going back to the company to purchase them again. So that would mean the company would sell them once and the farmers would save them and then have that technology, and that would be a violation of their patent. So in order to ensure that farmers would go back to the company every year and need to buy new seeds, they explored this technology that would render the plants sterile so that even if farmers saved the seeds, they would not grow the next year, and that's called the Terminator technology. And that became a source of very, very heated debate because, of course, if the Terminator technology, if a genetic mechanism that renders plants, crop plants, food plants sterile in the next generation, basically makes those seeds dead. If that got out and cross-pollinated, that would be very, very dangerous for our food supply. We could be looking at the demise of crop plants.
Lisa Wiesel is my guest. We're talking about her book, Food Fray. You can join us after the break at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Molecular biologist Lisa Wiesel is my guest this hour. She is professor of biology at Portland State University. Her new book is called Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. If you would like to join us, you can call now 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Lisa, one of the things that you will hear from companies who are developing this technology and selling it to farmers is that despite the fact that there's this huge concern in Europe where they call these things frankenfoods, American consumers just don't care. They're not bothered by the idea of having their foods modified in these ways. What did you learn about that?
Well, I think the biggest finding from my research is that Americans are generally uninformed or misinformed. So as many surveys have shown, most Americans think that they're not eating genetically modified food because it's not labeled and there's not a large awareness campaign. So that's really a case of misinformation. And then there's other, you know, ill-informed people who think genetically modified food is, there's, you know, pig genes in my lettuce and that they should stay away from the fresh produce aisle because that's where most of the genetic modified foods are, when in reality they're largely in soy and corn products and beginning next year sugar, which is usually processed ingredients. So it's not really that Americans are embracing these foods, it's that they're really not very aware of the fact that they're eating them. Europeans are much more informed, and because they have labeling laws in Europe, consumers have a choice there. Here, consumers pick up soy ingredients, canned corn off the shelf, and they really don't have any idea that they're produced using these genetically modified technologies.
One of the things you did was go back and look at how this was all reported in the media at the time that these foods first began to be available. And you saw a stark difference between the way that the U.S. media treated the subject or didn't treat it at all and what happened in Europe. Can you talk about the European response?
Yes, well, I think that the European response was connected to a lot of food safety concerns that were taking place in the late 90s and early part of this decade in Europe, particularly the mad cow disease epidemic, where particularly in Great Britain and the United Kingdom, there was mad cow disease. People were concerned maybe eating meat from these cows that had mad cow disease would cause humans to then, you know, have the same kind of symptoms. And the government really tried to reassure the public and say, this food is safe. Eating this meat is not going to give you mad cow disease. It's a disease of cows. And I was actually in graduate school in England at the time, and I remember seeing the beef in the grocery store stamped with the Union Jack and this nationalistic sentiment, we need to eat British beef, support the British beef market because it's safe. Well, lo and behold, it turned out that it wasn't so safe and that mad cow disease was transmissible to humans. And so there was a huge mistrust on the part of the public around food safety issues and government reassurances that these foods were safe. So I think the tie-in between the arrival of genetically modified foods just as this mad cow disease epidemic was beginning to break in the news and people were very anxious about food safety and the ability of the government to regulate and recognize these issues made a big difference. Here in the United States, we haven't seen that kind of thing. More recently, in the past year, to couple of years, we're seeing many more food safety regulatory issues coming up in this country, most recently the salmonella in peanuts outbreak, and, you know, real questions about how well our government is doing at regulating our food safety. So, but in Europe, the timing of the genetically modified food release and then the mad cow disease epidemic came together.
We should remind people that there is not any credible evidence at this point that mad cow disease or that salmonella in peanuts are related necessarily to genetically modified food.
Oh, absolutely not. No, they're different infectious agents that are causing those outbreaks, but it was the timing of having these kinds of food safety concerns come up that really influenced consumers and caused those issues to be linked in the media, or at least people to put those things together in their mind, this question whether the government's doing a good enough job of regulating food safety and you know, what kind of unintended effects might be coming out of novel foodstuffs.
On the other hand, you didn't see that the coverage in Europe, even of genetically modified foods, was particularly alarmist. It was simply very comprehensive.
That's right. It was comprehensive, and I think it was also more the way consumers and readers put those issues together in their minds. And, of course, Europe has a different food culture, a different food context, which makes a difference as well, and a different relationship to science and technology. So all of those things are put together. So when we look at the media and the reporting, we have to look at the context that consumers and readers bring to that reporting as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Lisa Wiesel's new book is called Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. Let's speak to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I graduated from the University of Colorado at Boulder in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology, and I just got to say, to a certain extent, I almost fear this topic more than biological weapons of mass destruction. And I want to say that the whole idea of, you know, the Terminator technology is just absolutely amazing. I mean, you bringing that up on this radio show is, it's like a Harvard critical thinking class for free. My question to you is basically just pretty simple, because I just want to know, where do you shop? What kind of food do you buy? And I guess that also plays into, what is your gut instinct on, like, are we going to suffer a catastrophic failure with these things eventually in some way, shape, and form that's going to hurt people?
What do you think, Lisa?
Sure. Well, I think these technologies are very powerful, the Terminator technology in particular, and I think we didn't quite get to the end of that story before the break. I do want to emphasize that companies did decide not to market that technology widely. It still exists. There are still rumors that it's, you know, there are plans being made to implement it. So as with many technologies, this is a very powerful and potentially devastating technology that we have, and it's really up to us as in society to make sure that it's used in a responsible way or not used at all, if that's what it means to be responsible. So there are technologies that have been developed and exist, and we really have to be very careful and proactive on how they're implemented. So that's just a follow-up on the Terminator issue in question. So in terms of how I shop, and I'm very lucky, I live in Portland, Oregon. We have a very strong food culture here and access to a lot of organically grown food, a lot of locally grown food, and a heavy emphasis on that. So we have farmers markets here in Portland most days of the week. I actually grow a lot of my own food because over the years in doing this research, I became much more informed and much more aware of some of these issues. And so I have a large garden. I live on a community that has a farm. So I'm very lucky in that way. And I do make choices for, you know, organic food and food that is has less treatment with chemicals and synthetic approaches, and so that necessarily precludes genetically modified ingredients if you buy organic food. So I'm very careful with the foods that I eat because I feel like I really do know a lot about some of these issues.
So clearly the giant companies that are producing and marketing these technologies have a vested interest in making sure that, that farmers grow them. What about governments? What sort of stake do they have in promoting or prohibiting this from being used on food that's being sold to their residents?
Well, first of all, I think that we can't totally separate government and industry because there's very heavy lobbying and there's a very strong influence, which some call the revolving door, between industry and government in terms of regulatory agencies, the USDA, the FDA, many people who have worked and held very high positions in some of these companies then move on to high positions in regulatory capacities at the FDA or the USDA and then often return back to those companies. So that's often called the revolving door connection. And then, of course, there's a lobbying pressure. And I think our government approach to agriculture is undergoing a change, as many things are with our new administration. And the USDA is really looking at some of these issues around subsidies and how all of that, those economic incentives for growing large-scale agricultural crops in maybe a not very sustainable way are promoted and maybe need to be changed. So I think that, yes, government has been complicit, especially in the past decade, in the past several administrations, in taking an attitude of deregulation, saying, well, you know, the companies are going to do the safety testing. If they say it's safe, it probably is. Just let them through. And there's been a real attitude towards government deregulation in many sectors. We saw it in the banking sector. And that's also been applied to agriculture. And I hope that going forward from here with our new administration and with some new leadership at the USDA, we're going to be seeing a real reconsideration of some of these policies.
There have been some fascinating, if you want to call them, international incidents surrounding this. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in Zambia recently?
Yes. So in 2002 and 2003, there was a food shortage incident. We often hear that referred to in the media as famine. But basically, in a number of sub-Saharan African countries, due to drought conditions that are recurring, there was a shortage of food. So people needed more food than the country could supply in the right place at the right time. So the United States is the only country that gives food aid in kind, which means we actually ship food grown here, put it on a ship, load it up, and send it over to Africa, and then disembark and distribute it there. Other countries, every other country, gives food aid in terms of money. So they give a set amount of money to the country. The receiving country can choose which food they want to purchase and from where. And often when food aid is given monetarily, countries will purchase food locally, either within their own country or in nearby countries. So for the way we give food aid, 65% of the cost of the aid goes to transportation, to the shipping costs. So we could actually give a lot more food, provide a lot more food if we gave the monetary value of that food. But we have a problem here because European countries and Japan, large export targets for our corn and soy, didn't want genetically modified food. So we had a surplus of genetically modified corn. So we shipped that, the United States government shipped that in the form of food aid to Africa. And Zambia rejected that food aid and said, we don't want to have that food aid if it's genetically modified and contains genetically modified ingredients. So that was really garnered a lot of international attention because people said, well, people are willing to starve rather than accept genetically modified ingredients. And when I was there on the ground, that was not really the case. But they did stand up and say no to it. So that garnered quite a lot of international attention.
And one of the concerns was that they might lose whatever European export market that they have.
That's right, because a lot of crops that are grown in Zambia does have an agricultural economy, and they do export a lot of crops to Europe. If there would be any cross-contamination incidents, if farmers planted some of that corn that was given as food aid, that genetically modified corn, and it then cross-pollinated with their own crops, then European consumers wouldn't accept that, and they would lose their, you know, rather small, relatively speaking, agricultural access to Europe.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Lisa Wiesel is my guest, and her book is called Food Fray. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I'm very appreciative of what the good doctor has to say today. I think she's bringing to folks' attention to things that are very much deserving of that attention. I think something that hasn't been brought up yet is Americans' attention as a consequence of corporate America's desire to keep us all fat, dumb, and happy. Americans tend to focus on the end product of a production process in deciding whether a product is good or bad for us, for society. And in fact, that's another story, is whether or not we even decide whether a product is good for society as a whole or not. But anyway, what hasn't come up yet is that I think the main problem with genetically modified crops is its impact on the environment and its unknown role in fomenting or extirpating species that have come to depend on the natural occurring varieties of those crops.
Yeah, thanks for your call. What do you think, Lisa?
I think there are issues around biodiversity that relate directly to the genes per se, because some of those genes are have insecticidal properties, and so there are concerns that a lot of pollinator species can be killed. Obviously, the monarch butterfly incident was the most widely publicized, but anytime you're putting an insecticide in a plant, and you're not able to regulate the application of it, the timing, et cetera, and it's, you know, openly available to any kind of insect, there's that possibility. And then there's just the question of biodiversity and monoculture. Because these crops are patented and there's intellectual property rights, farmers can't save the seeds, they can't cross them themselves, and that can reduce the biodiversity of the crop plant and make our food systems and the whole ecosystem of our food system vulnerable. Then another issue is the effect on soil bacterium and non-target species. So, when we have insecticides being produced in plants and that insecticidal protein exists in the soil and persists, there's effects on other organisms, such as the soil organisms, that microorganisms that many people are not aware of but are very, very integral to our whole food-growing ecosystem. So I think that yes, those environmental questions are very, very important to be addressed. And often people are most concerned, well, what about the harm to me? Is this going to kill me? Is this going to hurt me if I eat it? And people don't think beyond sort of their own personal connection and think into the broader environment of how our food is grown and what we depend on and rely upon for, for growing effective food.
So even if it turns out that it can be established once and for all that these foods don't directly harm human health, there are a lot of other things to consider in terms of our long-term ability to sustain life on the planet.
That's right, and just bigger questions about agricultural systems and the best way to provide enough food and enough healthy food for all consumers and the world, and whether the single gene approach is a short-term Band-Aid that might be yielding very high profits for some parts of our society versus considering a more sustainable approach that's better for the environment, better for consumers, and better for global food security.
Talk for a minute about what did happen to the monarch butterfly, because my understanding is it turned out they were vulnerable to something that no one had considered would be a problem.
Yeah, so the second kind, in addition to the herbicide-tolerant crops, the second main kind of commercially available crop is called BT. It contains a gene from the soil bacterium Bacillus thuringiensis, and that's a toxin that produces the protein that's toxic to Lepidopteran species, basically moths, butterflies, and it's toxic to their larvae. So pests like the European corn borer, root borers, caterpillars that come in and will infest the corn and eat it. So by putting that insecticidal gene into the corn, then the caterpillar comes along, takes a bite of it, and instantly dies, pretty much instantly dies. So the idea is if you can get that protein to be very specific for the target pest, that would be a good thing, but you don't want to kill off any of the beneficial insects that also belong to that same family, because then you would have a serious pollination problem and, of course, the bigger amplifications within the ecosystem. So the goal is to develop very, very specific forms of that crystalline protein. But, of course, mistakes happen, unintended effects happen. Lots in science, there's always unanticipated effects. And with the monarch butterfly, what they believe they were seeing was some effects on the monarch butterfly larvae. And, of course, the monarch butterfly is an icon of nature and natural beauty. And so that had a very strong emotional impact on people. But I think we also need to pay attention to the insect species that are beneficial but maybe don't have such a good rap as the monarch butterfly.
Lisa Wiesel is my guest. She's a molecular biologist at Portland State University. Her new book is called Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. We'll take more of your calls after the break at 1-800-933-5372 and read your emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is molecular biologist Lisa H. Wiesel. She is a professor of biology at Portland State University and has written a book called called Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. You can be part of our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we hear from Juan in Dallas. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Chris. Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
I just want to find out if somebody in the panel knows whether if the UN or some other organization is doing something about the genesis that this Dr. Mengele technology can do to humanity, as far as that Terminator process that is done with the genetic process food. It just sounds totally nuts to me that something can get out in the environment and sterile the nature as we know. And the CEOs, all these other people who are claiming ownership of this genetic processed food, I wonder whether if they're going to take any responsibility of any catastrophe like that. It might occur, and the UN or some other organization will do something to them. As far as I know, they can kill millions of people, just like a nuclear bomb.
Lisa, is there international regulation being considered?
Well, there's no internationally enforced regulation. There are things like the Cartagena Protocol, which promote the precautionary principle. The United States is not a signatory to that and does not comply with those suggested guidelines, but many other countries, particularly European countries, do. And I just do want to reiterate that the Terminator technology is not currently being used. It's developed, but there was a recognition that this was dangerous, and as companies developed this and the public learned about it, there was the recognition that this would not be a good public relations move, that there was too much concern and that it was too potentially risky to apply that technology. So while the technology does exist, it's not in current use. But it does have significant potential dangers. One of the complicating issues, though, here is that there's a lot of rhetoric, there's a lot of attention going out to this question, well, maybe these genetically modified crops can help solve world hunger, can save the world by producing more food or by promoting drought tolerance, these kinds of traits. And so I think bodies like the United Nations and the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO of the United Nations, have given mixed messages in terms of using biotechnology and how it should be used. And I'm a scientist. I'm a molecular biologist. I certainly believe that biotechnology can be used in good ways, that we should apply everything we know about molecular biology and genetics to learning more about crop plants and how we can get the plants that are the healthiest and grow the best under the changing climatic conditions. But this single-gene approach, transgenic plants, have a lot of limitations that I think get overlooked. And so I think that for large international regulatory bodies, there's a sort of mixed message because they're not able to separate out this idea that it's not science that's bad, it's the certain particular kinds of science that are being used and applied.
Let's go next to Corsicana and speak with Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hello there. When I was a boy growing up on the farm in West Texas, we used arsenic compounds to control insect pests. The compounds that are used today, the genetically manipulated products, are infinitely safer than they were back in those days. And I think your guest is an alarmist about the problems with that. And I also worked, I had a career with the Soil Conservation Service. We had one of the biggest problems with soil erosion is caused by tilling the soil. It pulverizes it. It makes it easy to blow away. It makes it easy to wash away. And so the weed control products that are available now are so much better for the environment. It's amazing. And I wonder if the National Academy of Sciences has done a study on this genetic manipulation and what their conclusions are, if any.
Thanks for your call. Lisa, what do you think about that? There are people who would rather eat this food than give their kids stuff that has been sprayed with pesticide.
Yeah, well, I think we can learn a lot from the arsenic experience. That, you know, at the time, we thought that that was an acceptable way to treat food, and later on we learned that that was had a lot of very significant health implications. So I think that it is important to learn from the past and not just uncritically embrace new technologies. That said, there are definite advantages to some of the technologies that we can use now. And I had previously just mentioned that I think there are some very responsible and beneficial applications of genetics and biotechnology. In terms of the specific insecticide use, the BT toxin that's engineered into plants, that was originally developed by organic farmers and is one of the few pesticides that's certified for use in organic food. It is not certified for use in organic agriculture in the genetically modified variety because that's a very uncontrolled use of that pesticide. The plant itself is producing the pesticide. It's produced throughout the entire plant, including the roots, with the effects on the soil. So there are those issues in terms of things are not all or nothing. The BT pesticide is relatively safe and so safe that it's certified for use in organic agriculture, but it's the way it's used and the application that causes it not to be allowed in the genetically modified form. So I think it is important not to be alarmist. There is controversy among scientists about some of the safety, some of the applications. This is a very, very political issue, And there are certainly very positive and beneficial applications of biotechnology. But I think we need a really stronger regulatory process and a better public information and public participation in this issue as well.
An email from Mike in Dallas asks whether research has been done regarding a possible link between GM crops and colony collapse disorder in honeybees.
So that was a hypothesis that has been put out there. And again, colony collapse disorder in honeybees appears to be something that's very multifactorial. I'm an amateur beekeeper myself, so I'm concerned about this issue. And it seems that our honeybee pollinators are being struck with mites, with viruses, all different kinds of environmental assaults, certainly pesticides, all of those things. We truck bees around the country to different locations to use them as pollinators, and that probably provides stress for them. So this issue of whether genetically modified corn in particular, these genes are causing colony collapse disorder, I think has pretty much been ruled out in the same way that many other single causative factors have been ruled out. But again, anything that puts stress on a system that's already so overtaxed may be part of a multifactorial system. So I think that there hasn't been definitive enough research to say that there's no role. And again, genetic modification involves many different genes, many different forms of, for example, the BT protein. So there could be unintended effects, but it's certainly not a primary cause of colony collapse disorder.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, we go to Waxahachie and speak with Brian. Hello, Brian.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks
Great.
For taking my call.
Sure.
I haven't read her book yet. Definitely interested in reading it, and I was wondering if she addresses at all the seed sharing that's happening in India due to unscrupulous companies like Monsanto, who are lobbying the government to enforce the farmers to use, I guess it would be the terminated technology seeds, but don't reproduce the next year. And I was wondering if she weighed in on that at all and what her opinion on that is, because it seems to me that if anyone has a bad opinion of genetically modified food, it comes from companies like that who are pretty brutal in their efforts to enforce their new product on third world countries.
Yeah, so I actually did a lot of field work in India across the board with the biotech industry, with small farmers working who really strongly opposed GM crops, with farmers who are using GM seeds. And I think that definitely there have been incidents where companies have done even illegal things, where they've released seed before it was approved. And the biggest problem in India is that there's not a lot of regulation of seeds, even though there are patent protections. Farmers will exchange seeds and save them from year to year, so that there are a lot of unapproved, particularly BT cotton varieties, available in India, things that farmers have crossed themselves that have perhaps accidentally been contaminated. So it's really very wild west market there of lots of different varieties of GM crops that farmers often don't even know that they're planting the GM crops. And at the same time, there's a very strong lobby against what many people feel is a forced application of GM crops to them, because they need to solve hunger problems, those kinds of issues. So I did some field work with a group of women farmers who are very actively saving their own seeds, as many, many farmers do in India and many developing countries, saving their seeds from generation to generation and selecting out those varieties that grow best under their changing climatic conditions. So it's very much across the board there are farmers that embrace BT cotton in India as well, because under certain conditions the yields will increase. So it's a complex mix of issues there.
Does there tend to be greater acceptance globally for crops that are not grown for human consumption, things like cotton, as opposed to something that might find its way to the food system?
Yes, definitely. Farmers that I talked to, people said, well, we don't really want to grow if we're going to eat it, but we might consider something like BT cotton, because cotton pests are a problem, and pesticide is external application of pesticide, which the BT crop would avoid, creates problems. So I would say definitely there's greater willingness to consider non-food crops used making this technology.
Let's go next to Elaine in Dallas. Hello, Elaine.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. I know that earlier in the show you said something about how we don't do experiments on humans, you know, like feeding them stuff and experimenting on them. We usually experiment on animals and stuff first. Well, it would seem to me that if 90% of the crops of like soybean or whatever is all GMO and it's not labeled, they actually are doing an experiment on us without us knowing about it. And I'll just take my comment, take your answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Yeah, and that is one of the issues when I went to Zambia and I asked people, well, why did you reject this food aid? Because this is corn that's grown in the United States that Americans are eating. And that was one of the arguments of the U.S. government. We're eating this and nothing's happening to us. We're fine. And one of the health officials I spoke with said, well, this sounds like a big human experiment to us because you're taking this food aid, feeding it to people who have only corn to eat because they have very little access to any other food. They're often immunocompromised, high rate of HIV infection and AIDS. People who receive food aid tend to be malnourished and sick and more vulnerable. And that sounds like a really big human experiment to take people who have compromised health and feed them large amounts of only genetically modified corn in a very unprocessed form. That sounds like a big human experiment. And so you could say the same thing for us in this country. Remember, of course, that most of the soy and the corn, which are the main genetically modified crops grown in this country for food, are used as animal feed. So we're eating it in a very processed form. If you look for corn ingredients, you know, high fructose corn syrup, that's very, very processed. So humans in this country, it's not like we're eating large volumes of you know, new proteins directly every day. If we see the spread of GM technology and some of these genes or new genes put into foods that are closer to us, less processed in the food supply, then I think that we might start to see some unintended effects depending on what the proteins are. So I think that we can't let this experience blind us to the fact that we need better safety regulation for any kind of new genetically modified crop. Just because we haven't had any significant health outbreaks with these current genetically modified crops doesn't mean that the safety, that any genetically modified food is safe. We need to keep up the safety testing, especially on new crops.
Lisa, is there significant development research taking place right now by entities not looking to, say, control the seed market and sell whatever it is that they're looking at and creating?
So are you talking about public research?
Yeah, public research and universities are land-grant universities trying to pioneer some of this technology without necessarily having a Monsanto contract.
Certainly, I think that there are very useful publicly-minded research going on in terms of disease resistance, some viral resistance, fungal resistance in some plants. But largely the balance of funding and energy and research attention is shifted heavily, heavily towards industry in this area. So this is an area where I think we do need to shift that balance back towards more publicly funded research, and then we might start to see some applications of biotechnology, of molecular genetics, in a way that might have wide-scale benefits and that might take a broader look and take into account the environmental impacts and health impacts to some extent, too, in a way that's more broad-ranging and all-encompassing, which would be more sustainable than just with a profit motive in mind. So I think we really need to shift that balance back towards more public funding for applying biotechnology in more sustainable ways.
Lisa Wiesel's new book is called Food Fray, Inside the Controversy Over Genetically Modified Food. Lisa, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.